So this is a story, the story of the cosmos, the story of Earth, the story of human, of gazelle, of mountain, the story of you and me. It is a narrative of one single integrated activity, universe. We wish to know what came first, what was the beginning, the event before all other events, the time before all other times. We don't know. It may be that we cannot know, and yet we have named it. The dream, the mystery, the quantum vacuum, God. 13 billion years ago, from that place that was no place, from that time that was no time, the cosmos flared forth in a silent blaze of inconceivable brilliance. All the energy that would ever exist in the entire course of time erupted from a point smaller than a grain of sand. Unimaginably vast quantities of elementary particles, light, and space-time itself unfurled and expanded from this quantum vacuum, this unity of origination. If, in the future, stars would blaze and lizards would blink in their light, these actions would be powered by the same numinous energy that burst forth at the dawn of time. 300,000 years later, thick with its power, the universe billowed out in every direction as the elementary particles cooled and stabilized, enabling the first atomic beings of hydrogen and helium to emerge. These elemental atoms were new unions made possible by the universe's powers of allurement drawing the elementary particles into bonded relationships. Neither inert, dead, nor passive, each atom roared with its own particular activities.
Galaxies emerged.
1 billion years of uninterrupted night enabled the universe to prepare itself for the next macrocosmic transfiguration. In the depths of its silence, the universe shuddered with the immense creativity necessary to fashion the galaxies, including our own Milky Way galaxy, over 100 billion galaxies in all. These gigantic structures pinwheeled through the emptiness of space and swept up all the hydrogen and helium into self-organizing systems and clusters of systems and clusters of systems. Each galaxy presented its unique form to the universe. Each brought forth billions upon billions of primal stars. The most brilliant stars rushed through their natural sequence of transformations and exploded in colossal supernovas that matched a billion stars in luminosity and spewed stellar materials throughout the galaxy. New stars formed out of those materials that had been created in the nuclear furnaces of these primal stars. The second generation stars were richer in complexity and possibly because the primal stars had created the elemental beings of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and all the other 100 elements. 5 billion years ago, the sun's mother star sacrificed itself in a supernova. New elemental powers were dispersed in all directions from the explosion so that the universe's adventure might deepen. 4,600,000,000 years ago, our Milky Way galaxy shocked the dispersed remnants of our sun's mother star into giving birth to 10,000 new stars, including our own, the sun. Once granted existence, the sun showed itself its own self-organizing abilities. 4.5 billion years ago, the sun blasted off most of the clouds of elements that were still hovering about it and spun the rest into our solar system. The charged early planets boiled as molten and gaseous materials. Each created its own story through its geological evolution. One among them, the Earth, formed in a way uniquely suitable for continued activity to unfold, due to its position in the solar system and the exact balance of its own internal dynamics. Over the next 500,000,000 years, as Earth's surface quieted and cooled, an atmosphere began to form. The first rains fell upon the Earth, and the oceans emerged. Water was continually exchanged between atmosphere and ocean. Mass upheavals of the crust formed great mountain ranges. Erosion brought rich minerals to the sea. These minerals, along with those arising from the volcanic action in the depths of the sea, provided a creative chemical womb and the conditions for a new and radically different step in the universe's development. 3,900,000,000 years ago, This vibrant and fertile womb brought forth the first living cells. These primal beings had the power to organize themselves, as did the stars and galaxies, and they had stunning new gifts as well. They could remember significant information, including the patterns necessary to knit together new living cells.
Cells invent photosynthesis.
Over the next 200 million years, the cells developed a new order of creativity as they learned to capture the packets of energy hurled by the sun at the speed of light, photons, using the glowing quanta as food, thus inventing the process of photosynthesis. By gathering their hydrogen from the oceans, the sun-eating cells, in their vast multitudes, released oxygen into the Earth's system. Over hundreds of millennia, the oxygen slowly saturated the land, the atmosphere, and the seas. By 2 billion years ago, the sun-energized cells had unknowingly pushed Earth's system into a condition beyond their own capacity to endure. The vast majority of the early cellular communities perished as their interiors were set ablaze by the oxygen. Yet out of this crisis, threatening the very viability of the living planet, arose a new and radically advanced being.
O2-loving bacteria plus the nucleated cell.
2 billion years ago, through the merger of separate and distinct living beings, the first cells with nuclei emerged. These new, more complex beings had the ability not only to endure oxygen, but to shape its dangerous energy for their own purposes. Thus, they seethed with creativity.
Sexual procreation emerges.
1 billion years ago, life was drawn toward union as these cells learned to reproduce sexually, thus vastly increasing the creative potential for new life. 600 million years ago, single-celled creatures took the daring step of submerging themselves into a larger mind as trillions of them gathered together and evoked the first multicellular being. Early animal life flourished on Earth as worms and spiders, snails, clams, and insects emerged. Eyes appeared, and Earth saw herself for the first time. 510 million years ago, the first fish moved through the oceans with their fleshy fins, developing backbones to protect Earth's earliest nervous systems. 460 million years ago, ocean waves left algae stranded on the shore. Unable to crawl home, they adapted to life on land, enlivening the long, barren continents in company with the insects who soon joined them.
Trees grow.
425 million years ago, plants developed wood cells and learned to stand upright, first living along the shores of oceans and rivers, and then transforming themselves into trees capable of covering entire continents with life.
Insects learned to fly.
395 million years ago, insects, cooling themselves by fanning heat away from their bodies, unexpectedly took off and became the first creatures to inhabit the sky. 370 million years ago, fish followed plants and insects onto the land, and soon the continents heaved with amphibians and reptiles.
Dinosaurs.
235 million years ago, the dinosaurs spread across the Earth in all their wonderful diversity of form, size, and life ways. Some, reaching up to the sunlit canopies, reached heights unsurpassed by any other creatures.
Mammals emerge.
215 million years ago, mammals emerged from the reptile family, bringing emotional sensitivity into Earth's living community, a new capacity within the nervous system for feeling the universe. Their developed parental care for their offspring has eventuated today into our deep concern for future generations of all species.
Yes. Okay.
Ladies
and gentlemen,
I'm very happy, although it is a little bit late, to welcome you in our open meetings, to give you a little bit of a background. We started these meetings 2-3 months ago, where we said, look, where we are talking about all the things we would like to have more input and participation and things like this. And somehow, in the beginning, it did not work. It was too static. And then we decided gradually, for let's now take one topic, and there's one person who is introducing it, and then we have a discussion of half an hour, and that's it. So short and powerful, and in that sense. The advantage is that we are a small group, and we have a direct interaction. The disadvantage is that most of the topics are of such a value that we would like to convey to Bazaarville as a whole, but that's something we have to figure out how we do it. L'Avenir is an organization of about 20, 25 people. We are coordinators in it. We have Saro, who's coordinating social economic affairs. Luigi, fund spending.
Fundraising.
Fund spending.
The problem is,
Tina is doing communication. Pashi is doing liaison, that is the daily work and protection and things like this. And I'm doing that the decision are taking in the right manner. Today we have energy on the agenda. Energy is usually done by the infrastructure team. The infrastructure team is at the moment in the working committee. That is Poonuswamy, but he can come any moment. And Pashi and Tuan are willing to take it over from Poonu, and I hope that will be a very nice Varuna presentation, but let's see how far we get. Thank you very much. If there's any questions, please do. And who shall I give the word to? Tuan, to you, or to Pashi?
Which wine did you drink yesterday
what?
Night?
Hmm?
Which wine did you drink yesterday night?
I cannot remember.
That's clear.
I can just say a few words. The subject is energy, but energy has many facets. So we felt at the moment the one which we were extremely well acquainted with and ready was the electrical element of it. And therefore today's presentation will be concentrating on the electrical energy, both on generation, distribution and utilization aspects. And Juan has put up the whole idea together on the basis of what is today's reality and what we are looking forward to in terms of our projections. So with this few remarks, I will ask Paul to take over.
Thanks, Pashi. So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
You know, we have today a mix of conventional electricity in our little TUB, which is about 3.2 megawatts. Now this looks very high, but this is actually the connected approved load. This is because we actually use 3.2 megawatts. We can use about 1.8 to 2. We have 337 kilowatt of photovoltaic, which is mostly the solar pumps. We have residential about 30 kilowatt. This is a rough estimate because we don't have a reliable database, but roughly 30 kilowatt. Solar street lights, 145 of them already. And then the Matamundia solar plant, which is 36 kilowatt. Matamundia solar plant takes fully care of all the lighting of Matamundia. This is a bit of a slow computer. Please go
ahead.
It's a 20 megabyte. Now these are the TEB consumption data of 2008. And as you can see, in 2008, our group consumed about 33 lakh of kilowatt hour. And a lot of it, 48%, is in the domestic sector, which is not very balanced. In most, say, normal society, domestic would be in the range of 25 to 30 maximum. We have different tariffs with TEB, as you can see in this column. And on average, we are paying 3.88 rupees. If you take the total amount of what we pay divided by kilowatt hours. Now, based on these numbers, I've calculated some per capita consumption data. If you look at our view total, the per capita, so per person annual consumption, is 1,700 kilowatt hours. Mm-hmm. If you take only the domestic sector, it is 1,000. If you compare that with India, all of India, it's 550. Tamil Nadu is higher, it's 1,000. Indonesia, 500. And on the bottom, you can see, of course, the United States, where they consume per person per year 12,000 kilowatt hours. Now, these numbers are a little bit distorting, because the smaller the community is, and our village is very small, the more you import from the outside society materials, you mix to that kilowatt hours and let it. You don't show up in your own kilowatt hour numbers. So actually, these numbers are even a bit higher, the outdoor numbers. Now, we are connected to a grid which belongs to the Tamil Nadu Electricity Board. Sorry. The Tamil Nadu Electricity Board is an organization that is owned by the government of Tamil Nadu. They have 10,240 megawatts of conventional energy. Hydro is still considered also conventional. There is 4,300 megawatts of wind power. What you have to take into account that in wind power, the capacity factor is very low. It's about 25%. So actually, 4,300 megawatts of wind is equal to about 1,100 of conventional. And then there is 6,000 megawatts of projects in the pipeline, which unfortunately mostly are thermal. Now, this thermal electricity board, they own a lot of assets. They have 1,63,000 of high tension lines. 1,200 substations. They have four load dispatch centers. They have 20 million consumers. Distribution transformers 1,80,000, and the total length of all the load tension lines is 5,70,000. Which we try to maintain all that. And the peak demand of Tamil Nadu was in 2009 achieved on the 29th of June at 10:35 in the morning, when they had 9,910. And that is about all that the grid can give. So you can see they are always operating at a very tight level without hardly any margin. Now, I have collected yesterday from a good friend of mine, you know, all this Italian stuff. I have collected yesterday's data of Tamil Nadu performance. It's very interesting to see. Here you can see a live. I should have brought my own computer. And the Italian speak also. There is, I have collected yesterday's data of the grid. Yeah, it's not yet coming. There's something going on. Where it shows yesterday's performance of the grid, the total demand, what was the peak load, what was the minimum load.
Now, is there something to press open or something?
Press annula.
Annula, okay.
No, yeah, no, the minimum one, sorry.
Sorry,
oh,
as a gift. Which is means?
Yes.
Execution.
Okay. Yes. Now again?
Yeah.
Ah, there it is. Control L. And then you should have a few. Now what does this show? I should do a full view. Could you do the full view, where is the full screen? Now this shows you, this is the Thursday's data, so this is just yesterday. And it is for the 24 hours which ended Thursday morning. Now what do you see here? You see that there was a lighting peak at 1850, which is right below. There was a minimum load at midnight, just after midnight, 1:50. And the morning peak was at 7:50. And why is there a morning peak in Tamil Nadu? Because of the agriculture. All the agriculture pumps depends on that. They run in the morning. Right. Now it may be difficult for people to read in the back. So I will read it from the screen here. The loads, the maximum load at the peak in the morning was 8,975 megawatts yesterday. And the lighting peak in the morning was 8,800. Now, if you remember the previous number which I gave you about the 9,900, which is the maximum, you can see how tight this grid is operating. And that is why you have this thing called load shedding. Because whenever there is a demand, can you put it back in the presentation mode? Whenever there's a gap between demand and supply, they have to take some growth off. And yesterday, they took 880 megawatts out of the system for certain hours. When we have the morning cut from 6 to 8, somebody else has from 8 to 10, somebody else has from 10 to 12, and that's why how we distribute the shortage of 800 megawatts amongst all these consumers. Don't forget that if the installed load is 10,000, it doesn't mean the 10,000 operates. Typically 80% of it. Yes, next slide, please.
Does it also include the distribution losses?
Yeah. Distribution losses are not shown here. Distribution losses are not shown in the network. It shows the kilowatt hours. So how many kilowatt hours do you have consumed and how much have you consumed? And the rest is theft and loss. Now, I have collected some data just very quickly of Chennai, which is a city of 6 million people. So just to get an idea, the demand is 1,800 megawatts, which is about one-fifth of all of Tamil goes to just to one city. They have consumed 34,000 million kilowatt hours last year. They have 18 lakhs of consumers. And if you go straight away to the bottom, they have to maintain 13,000 distribution vessels. I'm just showing this to give you an idea about the enormous responsibilities that this organization had in just maintaining one city. Next, please. Again, with you. Yeah. Just keep clicking till you start. This is the same thing. Next. They have 1,63,000 high tension lines. Oh, you're back to the biggest one. You're still page down. No. Page down. No, you're going back to the beginning. Next, please. Next. Yeah, here you can see that they operate in Chennai with two main voltages, one is 33,000 and one is 11,000. For our room, we also propose to go with 11 kV mainly. And they are, if you, one surprising number, which was surprising to me, they still have a lot of overhead lines. They have 3.3 kilometers of still overhead lines, even at high tension level, in a city like Chennai. Next, please. And this is the high tension network of TEP. The most important one to see is the last two, where they have about 1,600 kilometers of 11 kV lines, which is, you know, the high tension distribution in the city. Next, please. Now, why do we have power failures in our world? There are basically these five main causes. The first cause is load shedding, of which some is scheduled, like now it's 6 to 8 is scheduled, but sometimes it's unscheduled. When they cannot manage, they just do an unscheduled one. A lot of falls that happen is because of the trees, and you can see on the right side, you know, it's very difficult to run overhead lines through this forest, of course. The same thing happens with low tension lines. When the tree is hanging above the line, when it is dry, when it rains, the branch becomes heavier and then touches the line, even shorter. There's sometimes substation equipment failure. And very rarely it happens that the grids get separated. This means that one or two power stations fail, then you get a cascade effect and the whole grid collapses. This, like we have had in the past 5 years, maybe only 2 times, but it can happen. And that takes about 2 days to build up the grid again, because you have to start all the stations, synchronize them, and then only you can connect them up. Next, please. Now, what could be a possible powerful energy issue? And this is not only electric energy. I have taken it a little bit at a higher level, not just the technical level. I believe that our field will consume power or energy, not to fulfill our personal comforts or desires, but actually as an instrument to achieve a higher level of consciousness. I believe that we should have our field energy only from sustainable sources. Thirdly, if during the construction of the town we have to use conventional sources, and we have to, then we make it up in the future by producing more than what we have consumed. And I also believe, quite frankly, that in spite of Copenhagen and all the measures we are taking, the only real sustainable society is the one with a change of consciousness. Actually, we don't want to sustain the present society, because in our field we have recognized that man is a transitional being. So you don't want to sustain forever transition, you want to go to the next level of consciousness.
That is exactly what we say in Copenhagen. You want a climate change? Have an inner climate change.
Yeah, but you have to do both. You have to do the physical one also. Yeah. Otherwise, you can extinguish before you could even. Right. Like Mother said, you have to keep a fit body. My father put so much emphasis on the ashram of physical meditation. You cannot transform a body which is not fit. Right. So the planet has to be fit in order to be transformed. Next class. So what you get then as a strategy out of this vision is that you have a mix, and I strongly emphasize a mix of different sources. We don't have the luxury today to say we only go for solar or we only go for wind. You need to use all of them in a good mix, grid and off-grid, both standalone and central. And if you put all that together, including for heating and cooling and for transport, then you get a sustainable system, which is not only sustainable from the point of view that it uses only the natural resources that are sustainably available, but also a system that gives you energy security. I have nothing personally against grids. In fact, grids are very useful. You can actually use a grid as a battery. So I would recommend if we go for PV in a big way, then we keep the battery capacity to the minimum. Just for grids, 4 or 5 hours of outage. And pump the rest of the excess into the grid. The grid is like a huge lake, rather than having all these batteries which are actually a big problem for the power. Next, please. Now, I give you here about 10 crores worth of projects that are actually ready to go, which I have, this data I have collected from Hemant and Vishy in Alor. We have 240 electrical pumps in our group, which are highly inefficient. They were purchased in the early days, the IAC pumps, the KFD pumps. If we could replace them with more energy efficient pumps, we could save about 30 to 40% of energy. We could install another 25 kilowatt solar plant in Lockerville and get the air conditioning also running on PV. We could go for solar for the town hall, Maratiba, Citadine, a number of schools, pumps, including agricultural pumps. And there is a 250 kilowatt biomass plant. And the first phase of the biomass project also in the pipeline. So this is just a sample of a portfolio. We can make the list much longer. Just to indicate that there's plenty of opportunity for us to do renewable energy projects. Next, please. Now, wheeling of power. Many people have asked, what is this wheeling of power? Because in this whole Bahuna discussion, the word wheeling of power came, and people have asked me to explain today what it is. Wheeling is very simple. Normally, the wind farms are by this wind. So, typically in Tamil Nadu, the wind is in the south. So, you have wind near Kanyakumari, near the place called Upandal. So, if you have your wind turbine there, but you're actually having your consumption, say, Rahulville, how do you get credit for the kilowatt hour that you have generated there? And that is what they do with the system of wheeling. The power that you generate in the turbine is just pumped into the grid. Goes into this big lake, your electrons that you generate in the wind farm get mixed with all your electrons. And then you just consume your power as usual also from the grid, and you get a bill from the electricity board and pays you with the power that you have generated. So it is not that one electron or those electrons which you generate in the wind farm have a little label, I'm going to the town hall and it travels to the grid to come here down. It gets mixed up with all the rest. Next, please. And here you see an example of a typical wheeling calculation. So let's say, as an example, that you have consumed 37 lakhs of kilowatt hours in a couple of buildings on our, in a year. Right? And in that same year, you have generated in Kanyakumari or Coimbatore, say 32 lakhs of wind energy. So the gross energy that you yet have to pay is only 5 lakhs, because the rest you have generated. But then the TEB charges, wheeling charges, are 5%. Because you're using bare grid, so you have to add 5%. So your net energy payable is 6.6 lakhs, which is equal to 29 lakh 70,000 rupees. So from your original bill of 166, you come down to 29.7. So actually, you have generated a revenue of 4.28 rupees per kilowatt hour, which is quite interesting. And therefore, wheeling is the most interesting manner to tap wind energy. It is not interesting so much to sell to TEB because then they won't pay you this 428, they'll pay you maybe 320 today in the market. Next, please. Now, what are the wind energy challenges? Oh, well, this is, of course, a big challenge.
Oh my God.
So, the guy rang up and he said, what do? We knock down the tea shop or do we knock down the house? So, I said, instead of doing that, why don't we turn left and then we go straight and it worked out. But very often these big blades, which can be as big as 40 meters, and which are bigger than the wings of an Airbus V80, can create some problems. Next. Another challenge is sometimes you have to work in very difficult terrain, like here. You have to get these wind turbines and the blades and the towers up. And you have to make foundations, you have to make concrete, cement mixers, everything on this type of terrain. Not easy, but it works. Next one, please. This is a project which we did in Minnesota. For the first time in their life, about 25 engineers from India went out of India. And they, for the first time in their life, experienced snow. For the first time in their life, they knew what minus 25 degrees means. But in spite of that, they managed to commission this project on the target date of 31st December 2003 to the entire satisfaction of the customer. Next, please. Now, this looks like not a challenge at all. Nice road, just unloaded and covered. So why is it a challenge? That road came afterwards. We first put the turbines, and then they said, why not put the road next? Next, please. It was also fun in wind energy, because if you have to go to an offshore wind turbine, you are taken around in a helicopter. So here we are in a helicopter. Next, please. And then, of course, one guy had to go down and see what is happening. And luckily, it was not an electrical one. So somebody else went. Next, please. Then we have hybrid systems. This is a very nice system for a small wind turbine, just 5 kilowatts or 2 kilowatts. This is still a CFL lamp, but you could put an LED lamp now, much better, more PV. If you go from here on the East Coast Road to Chennai, you can see halfway on the right side, somebody has put something like this. It's right. But of course, there's a good wind there, which we don't have in our own so much. Next, please. Now, renewable energy can be expensive. We have to be very clear about that. Wind today, you can make it at 320 per kilowatt hour average. It depends on the wind speed and on the finance cost. 320, 350. Solar PV, even today, with the low cost of panels, with the high efficiency, are still in the range of 60 to 70 meters per kilowatt hour. This is the cost of the capital cost, amortized over 20 years, plus the financial cost. And then biomass is 3 rupees per kilowatt hour. But depends very much, of course, whether or not you incorporate in the cost the market value of the land that you use. That is a factor which can spoil the market. And this is all based on equity debt ratio of 1:3, so basically 25% equity, 75% debt, and I've taken a finance cost of 11%. Next, please.
This one includes the cost of building the whole thing and equipment.
Everything.
So the way it goes for, so you cannot really compare this actually, if I'm wrong, you cannot compare this with BP or thermal because there the whole cost is completely subsidized by the government.
You see, especially in nuclear, they don't take into account, for example, the problem of storing the radiation and the stuff. In thermal, there is a different type of subsidy because the pollution to the environment nobody pays for.
Right.
So in fact, I'm always against people saying that, you know, the renewable is subsidized. No, actually, conventional subsidy. But there's an unspoken subsidy. Nobody articulates it. But actually, it's a subsidy. Okay, this actually Pune Sahni should have done. And this is the key lines today in our village. Today means a couple of months back. The blue lines are the high tension lines, the green ones are the low tension ones. Now, what we have managed successfully in all these years is whenever the TEP came with a proposal to lay high tension line, we have pushed them to the bottom. As you can see, there are very few high tension lines within the city area. I still remember that in 1979 or so, the TEP wanted to lay a line from Bharatibas, from here, straight to Taxnalia, which was then at the work, good work with Revelation today. And I had to go all the way to Chennai to talk to the chief engineer to persuade them not to do that. And then, of course, they have laid a line like this, which is following the outer circle of most of the city. So we have tried as much as possible all these years to push high tension lines to the periphery. Next, please. Now, how do we transition from the system which you just now saw to an Auroville distribution system? The first step is that we take bundles of low tension services, for example, Town Hall, Matamundi, Bharatibas. two terminals there, make a high tension connection of say 150 kilowatt, take 11 kilowatt high tension supply, and everything after that is then ours. Then we get rid of the overhead lines, low tension overhead lines. We have to replace the TDB outdoor transformers with our own indoor ones. We have to replace TDB LT lines overhead with underground cables. And you have to replace the 22 kV overhead lines of TDB with 11 kV underground. Now this needs a fantastic planning. Because first of all, you need to have roads along which you can lay these cables. You can't lay them just in the middle of nowhere. I strongly recommend that you should lay those roads physically and then only lay the cable. Because even if you have the best marking, afterwards you realize that actually the road should be 1 meter more on this side and the whole cable plan goes for a toss. Next, please. The outdoor electrical grid would compose of the following main components. One is there would be an 11 kV rail along the ground. Actually, the Galaxy model is an electrical engineer's dream. Because electrical engineers always like rings. In fact, water engineers also like rings. Because in a ring, what you can do, you can see it from two or more points. And if one of the two figures fails, you connect the rest of the ring to the first figure. So you would have a ring of 11 kV. You would have 11 kV spur lines into the sectors. You would have 11 by 0.43 kV distribution transformers, which I strongly recommend are integrated into the buildings. LT underground cables. Feeder pillars, again integrated into the buildings, not separated on the stick. Very energy efficient systems. I mean, what is even in big projects, I have noticed that people do not spend enough time in calculating the energy losses in the system. And by just increasing a cable size from, say, 25 square meters to 35, you could, you know, earn that money back in less than a year because of the energy savings. The grid would be fed from out of the grid-connected renewable energy sources, also from non-grid-connected sources, of course, but I'm talking here about the grid. And the basic idea is that we achieve when we are there, maybe 20 years from now, 15 years from now, that we have a surplus, that we send that surplus to the grid. But in a period when we have shortage, we import from the grid in such a manner that at the end of the year, we are either equal or we have given a surplus. And the smart grid technology, which is now being worked on even by Infosys in Bangalore, is a technology that tries to predict what the grid is likely going to do in the next couple of minutes. And then very quickly react to it. Today what is happening is, if you go to Chennai, to the load dispatch center, you see a huge room like this, full of computers. People are trying to match, mostly automatically, demand and supply. But it is too slow. And it is doing, it takes very crude decisions. Okay, start 600 megawatts, you stop 100 megawatts there, it is very crude. So a more subtle management of the grid, and more almost on the fly, is what the smart grid technology is going to achieve. And smart grid technology will also help in renewables, because today, technically speaking, you can't have more than 20% in a grid as renewables. Why? Because renewables are not steady, except for biomass. Solar is not available at night, and wind fluctuates. So the 20% of fluctuating power has to be absorbed by the 80% of steady. But with smart grid technology, we expect that the 20% can increase to 40, 50, even more. And that's why this is a very important technology. Next, please. Now, how could we design a 11 kV grid for our world? It's very simple, I'll show you. Next, please. They keep on giving. I mean, it is so simple. Thanks to the shape of the town. Something like this. I mean, this is just an example. And then let's hope it fits. Keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah,
it fits. So, this is how you design electrical system model. Could be easy. Next one. Of course, you have to connect to the grid. Don't forget. Here also, there. Yeah. Now, what is the work we have already done? We have already developed, we are probably one of the first or few institutions in the country who have their own code of practice for electric installations, which we have designed already in the early 80s. It needs updating, actually, recently, but it is a very clear code, talking about cable sizes, wire sizes, polymers, depths of cables, sizes of polymers, you know, just everything is there. And if you would open any box here, you'd probably see you very sincerely following those color codes. Then we get a concept electrical distribution plan with development consultants, stuff like that. Then a municipal energy plan was done under the Asia Arts project. AVS has developed it further into a first draft electrical distribution. Then we have, of course, ongoing, every day, you know, LT distribution plans for Citadine, for residential zone, which is going on every day. And recently, a breakthrough has been achieved by AVS with TEV that we are now allowed to put the meters of TEV at the tail end of our cables. There's one legal detail still to be worked out, but this is a good breakthrough. Next, please. Now, the Asia Earth study, which was done in concluded in April 2003, had the following main conclusions. They have estimated 32 megawatts for the whole town. I think this number will become lower because of more energy efficient systems. Like, this was still based on incandescent bulbs. Now, LED is going to be about 1/20 on that. So the whole lighting look can drastically change, for example. They had expected that because of the renewable energy developing, it will play a major role, which has come out already now. For the first phase of 5,000, the expectation was 6 megawatt. I think it's going to be more than in the range of 3 to 4. And energy efficiency in lighting, heating, and cooling, even in heating, is of course a very important component. Next, please. The 5-year plan that was made for the 5,000 population in that particular project had provided for one substation of 22 to 11. See, we have one peculiar problem in this area. The 22,000 volt system around Kamunda is non-standard. In fact, it is only there in a few parts of Kamunda. The standard voltages are 11, 23, 66, 110, 220, and 400 kilovolts. And you saw in the earlier picture which I showed about Chennai, there was no 22 at all. So my concern is if you could start installing here 22 cable equipment, you might even come in a situation in 20 years from now that you can't get spare parts, because 22 is going to be phased out. So what we have to do is we have to step down from 20 to 11, and later I feel we should even take 110, another 10 kilovolts from TEB and have our own substation and step down directly to 11, and then have an 11 kV system. Next, please. Now, what is the work now in progress and what is the work planned? There is a sustainable energy plan being made with the energy platform of participatory planning. Some people are doing by here. We are going to make a new edition of the Outlook Code of Practice, where we also want to put a, like, you know, new LED lamps and not conventional lamps. The external electrification planning is going on as we speak. A more detailed electrical distribution plan up to the transformer has been made, knowing very well that it might have to be changed. But if you have that, then you have at least a reference that any project which comes up. See, the problem in our village is that projects don't come sequentially. Suddenly somebody has money for one pocket of our bill for a project. And then the project is built, but the infrastructure of the project should plug into the puzzle of the totality tomorrow. And that's why we need to have the puzzle ready. Sustainable Energy Systems Initiative, I showed that long list of about 9.7 crores worth of projects. We should start implementing one year now. And then installation of electrical vehicle charging stations for charging the electrical two-wheelers. Already there is one in New Creation and more of them will come. Next, please. No. Now, we need people. No. We can't do anything. It's nice to have a PowerPoint, but you need people to implement. I made a rough estimate of what we would need in terms of human resources already next year, just next year, 1 year. We need an energy planner. We need at least two project managers to manage and drive design and planning. We need external consultants, I think one or two. We need people to implement projects, minimum four. We need four electrical engineers at a minimum. Supervisors, at least six to be taken into the team. Energy auditors, I think we should have maybe first one and later two. Energy auditors who walk all around our building, not to audit books of account, but to audit installations. like Hemang pointed out, 240 pumps. If they are replaced, we can save so much of energy. I'm sure there are many other items that you can discover as an energy auditor. Next please. And then, of course, administrative support. Yeah, and the last slide is save energy, because every kilowatt hour saving is a kilowatt hour generated, or is a kilowatt hour less to generate. Yes.
Just one thing. Thank you very much. You said that you prefer to build a road first, and I understand the logic with the not moving things, but part of that you said that we are doing this to see the linkage. And if, let's say, you can, as a group, can agree about the way the infrastructure is going to be developed, and then you're going to build a road, so why not to, is that enabled to understand what is the space required for the infrastructure to design something that when you build a road, you already put it in, underneath the road. You don't have to put the cables, but you have the space and you design something like a box that enables the infrastructure to be fit in. So you don't need to break the road again to put the infrastructure. You do it together. This is one question.
Shall I answer this one first?
Yes.
You see, I said you should first build the roads. That's the ideal situation. At the minimum, what you have to do is, you have to physically mark them. And permanently mark them. Not come back after 3 months that they have to be shifted by 1 meter. And then you have to mark, not under the road so much, but by the side of the road, within the right of way, a service corridor. You don't put cables under the road, you put them by the side, 10 feet under the footpath. Then you have to decide, okay, where will the low tension cable come, high tension cable come, telephone cable come, fiber cable come, water supply come. You make a complete cross-section of one or two service corridors. I mean, very often you put wet on one side and dry on the other side. So as long as at least the service corridors are really marked physically with stones, and we all agree that that's it, then you can lay those cables. But the biggest mistake you could make is you lay the cable now, and then later, when we do a detailed survey before construction, we discover, the alignment doesn't work, the whole road has to be shifted by 1.5 meters. And then what are you going to do with those cables? And the cables come out of the building. So all I'm saying is, normally cables are laid along with the roads. As the road is being built, the cables are laid. Sometimes they are laid just after the road is constructed. If you want to do it in an earlier phase, because you are faster with your infrastructure development than with the road part of it, at least make sure that you mark physically on the land with proper survey instruments the right of way for the services. And decide today where will come each of the services that I mentioned. Otherwise you make a mess. Already 80% or more of the cables which are laying out today are in the wrong place. Other than the wrong place, they have to be shifted one way or the other. They have been laid along organically on cycle paths, right? Or, you know, some rope which is temporarily being used. Now, fortunately, the amount of cables that we have laid is very little. But with this type, these cables which are mentioned there are extremely expensive, and you don't want to, you know, relay them later. So, in conclusion, you don't have to make a rope, but at least you have to mark it.
My second question, I really like the idea of the lake of nets of relationship.
Which one? Lake of?
You say that we, for example of looking at like a lake.
Here is a lake, yes.
And feed in and take as much as you want. My question is, how that can accept the future? We cannot, it's hard to anticipate what kind of energy product we have, supply product in the future. But how much that you think can predict and allow new energy systems in the future to fit in into it and or they need or they need totally require a different infrastructure?
You see, the nice thing about electricity is that irrespective of the source, it is still the most efficient way to transport energy. Much more, for example, than transporting gas bottles or oil lines. The nice thing about electricity also is that generation, transmission, distribution, and consumption are instantaneous. There's no delay. The only thing that could happen in the future is that technology develops in such a manner that you have more decentralized systems rather than centralized systems. And that you could actually have houses running almost or buildings independently. But even then, you will never ever have a technology where supply and demand every minute are matching. So you need to have outlets to send your surplus energy and to take your shortage. And that's the whole purpose of the grid. And I think that technology of how you connect things together will not really change much. Yes, what will change is what I mentioned in one slide is the smart grid technology, where the grids get more intelligence. Now they are just rough and tough, as you have noticed.
So can we learn from it that the grid need to be in a way accessible for changes, so we can
yes, as long as you give it the right frequency and the right voltage. I mean, if you have a 50 hertz, then you should give 50 hertz. But that is not a big issue. Yeah. Any other questions?
Any chance of wireless?
That was also my dream when I was 4 years old. In fact, even as an experiment. But if that was true, then of course that wireless energy of say 1 megawatt would also pass through you and my head, right? So I don't think people exist very long. Unfortunately, energy will have to go through something. That's like water. And the water goes through a pipe, and the electricity has to go through a conductor.
Sally, she has an experiment done last year at Harvard, and it's 4 meters.
You can measure even 100 meters point to point. But, you know, don't pass through the path when they are doing experiments. You will vanish immediately.
Well, there's a program starting to bring overhead cables in the ground.
Yes.
What is your, is this a good plan, not a good plan, but what is your...
In principle, the plan is good, but what I have seen so far, and in fact, I was hoping that Kunisami would join, the plan, which is laying there today, with the arguments given for it, don't make much sense to me, quite frankly. I have also prepared a note for Lamineer and distributed it. Yeah. The plan is to take from that, you know, you saw one drawing with all the horrible lines, to take some pieces of it, and remove the EDP and replace it with a piece of 22,000 volt aluminum cable. I would not do that. I mean, I would do, first of all, in any case, if you insist to do it, just to be done, as we said earlier, along the marked service corridor, so we don't have it. And the reasons that they are given in the PowerPoint presentation, or the arguments rather, are not being addressed by the solution. One argument was that if you put a high tension line in some places, the local villagers cannot get electricals or connections, so they will be more eager to sell the land. That argument doesn't work. If your turn has come for electricals or connection, you get it, period. The second argument which was given is that it will reduce the breakdowns. But it's very nice that in 12 kilometers of overhead line, you have replaced 3 kilometers with underground, but the 9 kilometers still there are trees touching. So that is also not really solving it. The third argument which was given that will help the Varuna project, because then we can wield the power from the wind farm of Varuna to Oliver. But for wheeling of power, you don't need high tension cables. You need high tension service connections. And that proposal which I saw does not have any high tension service connections. And there was maybe a fourth argument. This was it, I suppose. This was the argument. So I was actually planning to visit Lavinia one of these days and to understand maybe there's a fourth or a fifth argument which was not articulated. But the ones which I articulated were not justified project at all. In fact, it is even risky because if you lay these cables today, and they are going to be laid in a forest, going to appear a little bit. If tomorrow, God forbid, somebody starts digging there, and he thinks that the concrete slab over the cable is actually a rock and it continues, then that is gone.
Oh.
So I would not do it, quite frankly. But let's discuss. Maybe there is some argument which has not yet met the daylight and which convinces it. But as of now, I'm